Now, if you read through Luke, and we've looked before about the fact that Luke is he's a historian, and he's trying to share with one of his, perhaps his Roman friends or something like this, he's trying to share the historical things about Jesus to help him to understand who Jesus was and is. And therefore, you might find it a little funny that Luke brings out this passage quite close to the start of his book. Because in this passage, we have people with which he grew up with rejecting him. They're hearing all about him, and then they reject him, which seems a strange thing to begin your book with. Why would you start a historical account about Jesus, God's son, and then start off by saying, well, actually, he was rejected by the people he grew up with? That seems a strange thing to get going with. And so we need to pick that out as we're going along in this passage. And there's three lessons that I want to pick out from this section in Luke. So I've called this first section the patience of God. The patience of God. So we read right at the beginning of this passage, and Jesus came to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up. So if we think back to the Christmas story, he was born in Bethlehem, as the prophets had announced. And then he went to Egypt as they fled from Herod. But then he came back and he grew up in this town called Nazareth in the Galilee area. So this is where he grew up. And he's now come back. He's in his 30s, approximately that sort of age at this point. And he comes back to his hometown. And it's the Sabbath day. So that's the Jewish Saturday, the end of the week. And what does he do? We find that it was his custom, his habit, to go into the Jewish synagogue on the Sabbath day. And this was the first thing that I wanted to note that's important for us. As I was reading one of the commentaries, I just picked out this point myself and thought, that's interesting, that he goes into the synagogue. And I found this quote by William Barclay. It says this: it was Jesus' habit to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath. There must have been many things which he radically disagreed and which grated on him, yet he went. The worship of the synagogue might be far from perfect, yet Jesus never omitted to join himself to God's worshipping people on God's day. I don't know how long you've been going to church. Maybe this is your first time in a church. Maybe you've been going for pretty much every week since you've been small, which is more my experience. And I was going to do an exercise the other day of trying to count up how many services I've likely to have been on. But if you consider, perhaps, you know, if I started going when I was three, and there's 52 weeks a year times my age, which is less than 100, then, you know, the idea. But I've been to lots of church services, and I've been to a variety of different churches. I've been to the Brethren style churches when I was younger. I've been to Anglican churches. I've been to Baptist churches. I've been to Pentecostal churches. I've been to all sorts of churches. And can I just say that I didn't always get on with everyone in those churches. There have been some funny characters in some of those churches, and I'm sure if you've been going to church a while, there are probably people in your mind that you can think, they were a bit odd. You know, there was one church that I went to, and they were so used to speaking in sort of King James language that they would mentally translate everything they said into "these thous and thines" in all their speech. It was really odd that they could do that. If you were just talking normally with them, they'd be okay. But when they got in a church setting, everything was sort of translated into about 400-year-old English. It was really odd. Or those who've been to house group with me will know that I've had said this before, but there's been someone in our previous church who was a wonderful character. He came from Africa, but I can distinctly remember his accent And he would often start everything he said with was, "The Bible says," and then he would quote what it have. And so whenever Liz and I want to joke about what the Bible says, "The Bible says," and I think back to Isaac, who I knew. And I'm sure you could pick out people you think, those idiosyncrasies about those people that you've met in church. And to be honest, you're probably looking at me and you're thinking, yeah, he's one of those guys that I could pick out his idiosyncrasies and the things he does that are a bit strange. And that's fine. But the fact is, we also have difficulties with church. People leave churches because we don't get along. Now, I've had a different sort of experience in the last few weeks because, as Paul said, I've been abroad. So I've been in Switzerland 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and then in Germany the last couple of weeks, meeting with family and friends. And so a few weeks ago, this was more my experience. Now, I had really hoped that it would come out a bit clearer. You can see the sort of windows at the back of this room here. This is up in the Swiss mountains. Okay, so I was looking out, and it doesn't quite look like this. This is at one of the top of one of the hills. But you've got the Alps in the distance. You've got the villages. You've got the trees. It was beautiful. And you can see I've got many of my family here. There's my dad right at the center here. There's my cousin at the front there. We even got Ruth and Paul there, I think. But I was with my family. I was with multiple nationalities. There were German people there. There were Swiss people there. There were nationalities of other ones as well. I don't even know who they were. As we were meeting for a 50th birthday party out there. And I thought, this is great. Wouldn't it be like this if church was like this all the time, that you could meet like this and there were all these prayers and different people playing the instruments and, you know, family and great preaching, unlike today. And I thought, this would be great to look out on these views. Wouldn't that be marvelous? But the fact is, when we go to church like this, like the synagogue was, there are going to be things that we radically disagree with. There are going to be things which grate on us. I am sure there are some of you with the style of the service today who would probably be thinking, this is not how I choose to do it. But the fact is, Jesus made it his habit, his custom, to go to the synagogue. I think it's unlikely that when it comes to the end of the service, you're going to try and throw me off the top of a hill. But that's what he faced. But he went. It was his priority to meet with the people of God. And somehow we have got to make sure that as God's people meeting here, those who are regular members, we don't give up meeting together. Somehow we've got to get past those things which grate on us to get to the heart of what it means to be church. We've got to get to the point where we are following on the same path of seeking to fulfill Jesus' mission to disciple those, to bring the gospel to all nations, to teach them what Jesus taught himself. We want to come to worship together in different styles and yet somehow have that togetherness, that fellowship, that we are going to make it our habit to meet together. And I just wondered, if I went to your friends or family and said, how much of a priority is it for so-and-so to come to church, what would they say? What would it take for you to have to miss being here? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that at all costs you need to be here. I don't think it's a requirement. It's certainly not part of our salvation that we are here every week. And I was thinking through that we've just, I don't know whether you did it last week or not, with the temptations of Jesus. But I don't think Jesus, when he was fasting in the desert, thought, okay, it's a Sabbath day. I better go back down to the synagogue. I don't think he was there for those times. It's not wrong not to come to church, but I do wonder, what is our level of commitment to church, to meeting with God's people, even when it's hard? That's the first thing I wanted to challenge you with. But Jesus shows that God is patient. He was patient with these people who were even going to reject him. He was patient through the things that grated on him in the worship of God. He still went. And he did these things. I present to you the patience of God. Secondly, the grace of God. So Jesus comes into his hometown, Nazareth, and he comes into the synagogue, and as we're told, he's given the scroll. And he's given the scroll of Isaiah. I don't know if the whole of Isaiah was in one scroll. It seems pretty unlikely, but he's given a scroll. And he stands up to read. So the custom was that you stood up to read. They'd probably have a similar sort of thing to a lectern. And then when you came to teach, you would sit down. So it wasn't odd to sit down. That was the expected thing. So he opens up the scroll and he reads from Isaiah chapter 61. Now he doesn't read very much. It's just the first couple of verses. So the Spirit of the Lord is on me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And everyone's expecting him to carry on. He's in the middle of a sentence. I don't know if they actually have sentences in Hebrew, but in our Bibles, he's in the middle of a sentence because it goes on to talk about the vengeance of the Lord. But he stops mid-sentence. He ends at the year of the Lord's favor. And then he rolls up the scroll again. He hands it back. Probably not like that. And then he sits down. And just like now, you could probably hear a pin drop. It says, their eyes were fastened on him. Why has he stopped there? And so you can imagine that, as was the case, perhaps he would go back to those times and thinking about the past. Maybe he would think about the times of David and the life of David and the greatness of the kingdom, and he'd talk about this kingdom to come, the year of the Lord's favor, and he would excite everyone with what God is going to do. Maybe he would talk through some of those prophecies. Maybe he'd talk about how God was going to rescue his people, particularly from these Romans that were oppressing the people. And he would share about that and again excite the crowd there about what God was going to do. But he doesn't. He says something which would have been quite astounding for them, in the same way that if I sat down and said, oh, by the way, I've just fulfilled what I read. Because that's what he said. He said, today. Nothing about the past. He said, today. What I've just read, it's come true. And I think rightly so, if I was to say, I've just fulfilled that, you would be questioning me and saying, eh, what? Prove it. Prove it. Give some evidence. And that's what they're facing. And then he goes on to speak, and we don't hear what his sermon is. He says he began to say to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in his hearing, in their hearing. And he began to carry on. But the flavor, the theme of what he said was God's grace. God's grace. To proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. There is a coming time for judgment from God. Isaiah talks about that, the vengeance of the Lord. Those who have done wrong are going to be paid back. Those who are evil face judgment for what they have done. But here, Jesus comes to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And they marveled at themselves. They say, they spoke well of him and marveled at their gracious words that were coming from his mouth. I wonder how you define grace. What is grace? This is what Philip Yancey, an author, had to say about grace. He wrote a book, I don't know if any of you know it, called What's So Amazing About Grace? And someone asked him the question, can you define grace, having just written a whole book about it? And he says, I don't even try. Jesus talked a lot about grace, but mainly through stories. I remember once getting stuck in Los Angeles traffic and arriving 58 minutes late at the Hertz rental desk. I walked up in kind of a bad mood, put the keys down and said, "How much do I owe?" The woman says, "Nothing. You're all clear." I said, I was late, and she smiled. "Yes, but there's a 1 hour grace period." So I asked, "Oh, really? What's grace?" And she said, "I don't know. They must not cover that in Hertz training classes. I guess what it means is that even though you're supposed to pay, you don't have to." That's a good start to a definition. What's grace? I would say it's that unmerited favor. You haven't earned something, but it gets given to you anyway. It's unmerited. You haven't done anything to earn it. It's just given to you anyway. Grace is incredible. What grace can do for a person. We could also talk about ungrace, those times when we could have given out grace to someone and they don't receive it. I tried to think of some examples from my own life of grace, and I came up with these two examples. Here's an example of ungrace for you. Has anyone ever played the card game Pit? Scott is nodding at the back. Pit is probably one of my favorite games. If you get a big group of people, it is such raucous fun, it's brilliant. But the game of Pit, you're trying to collect your cards together, but everyone is simultaneously trying to swap cards with each other. And in amongst the cards that you do want, there's a card that you don't want. The bear. Is that right? It is the bear, not the bull, isn't it? It's the bull and the bear. You don't want the bear. If you end up with the bear at the end of the game, you lose your points, lose some of your points. And I remember I took Liz, before we were married, to meet my school friends. And we went round to someone's house and we played a game of Pit together. And this was her first time playing it against the rest of us boys that had played it for a number of times. And it became clear throughout the game, you begin to know where the bear's gone, okay? And it was coming very close to the end of the game. And there was Liz shouting out, "One, one, one," because she wants to swap a card. And everyone plainly knows it's the bear. And so who is the chivalrous gentleman that takes the bear from her? Not me. Not me. She ended up with the bear at the end of the game. She didn't deserve any more than anyone else to have the bear or not have the bear, whatever. But I have the opportunity to show that grace, to take the bear from her and lose out myself so that she didn't have to pay the cost. But I didn't take it. It was ungrace. And we could, I'm sure we could pick hundreds of examples of grace where we could show grace, where we did show grace, where we've received grace. Can I tell you once, maybe this will be a surprise to my parents, I don't know, if I can't remember if they told the story. I once left Liz. I walked out. I left home. So we had recently had Daniel. He was a little baby at this point. And I was exhausted. We're just tired out. Everyone who's had a new baby knows what it means to be tired out. And I just had enough. And Liz had been on the phone, and I think Daniel had been crying, and I just had enough. And she got off the phone, and I shoved Daniel to Liz, and I walked out. I couldn't take it anymore, and I walked out. I hadn't taken anything with me, so I decided just to walk. I decided I was going to walk to Wasatch, and I was going to stay there all night. And then I got cold. So I sort of started walking back again, having not got to Wasatch. But I thought, I can't go home, because Liz is going to be ashamed of my behavior of walking out, and how could I do that to her? But as I said, I was cold, so I thought I'd better go home. So I went into the lobby, and I lay down in the lobby. And I decided I'd sleep in the lobby rather than try and slink back into bed. But I was so uncomfortable in the lobby, eventually I just got fed up with this. I hadn't been gone for very long. So I went back to bed. I just thought, I'm just such a terrible person. How could I have walked out on my wife? And it's just so amazing when you know that you've done something that's not great, done something wrong, and the person says to you still, I love you. She wasn't hating me. She wanted to love me. She was concerned about me. She wanted me back. And I've never forgotten that time when I left her and came back about 2 hours later and we could carry on together. Grace can be life-changing. I don't know how many of you know the story by Victor Hugo of Les Miserables, if that's how you pronounce it. I don't know if you've read the book or seen the film. There is a character in that story called Jean Valjean. And he's a convict. He was put into prison for theft. And eventually he's let out on parole. But there is no life for convicts at this point. He's tarnished by his previous reputation and has no life. And so he goes off and starts to head towards his parole officer in Dijon. And eventually he's just trying to find a place to sleep for the night. And eventually he goes to effectively the vicarage. And he goes and knocks on the door and he just asks them for a place to sleep and a meal. And they grant it to him. And he's just so surprised that they were taken. He's already shown his convict papers, but they welcome him in anyway. In the night he gets up. He steals all the silverware that they've been eating with at the meal. And when the bishop, he comes down, he discovers him stealing these things, he knocks him over the head, and he runs off. And this is where we pick up the story. Martin, if we could have the lights off, that would be great. Sound ready, Josh?
So we'll use wooden spoons.
I don't want to hear anything more about it.
I'm sorry to disturb you.
You caught him.
But I had my eye on this man.
Oh, and thank God.
I'm very angry with you, Jean Valjean.
What happened to your eye, Monseigneur?
Didn't he tell you he was our guest last night?
Oh, yes. After we searched his knapsack and found all this silver, he claimed that you gave it to him.
Yes. Of course I gave him the silverware. But why didn't you take the candlesticks? That was very foolish. Madame Gillot, fetch the silver candlesticks. They're worth at least 2,000 francs. Why did you leave them? Hurry. Monsieur Valjean has to get going. He's lost a lot of time. Did you forget to take them?
Are you saying he told us the truth?
Of course. Thank you for bringing him back. I'm very relieved.
Release him.
You're really letting me go?
Didn't you understand the bishop?
Madame Gillot, offer these men some wine. They must be thirsty.
Thank you.
And don't forget. Don't ever forget. You've promised to become a new man.
Why are you doing this?
Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil. With this silver, I've bought your soul. I've ransomed you from fear and hatred. And now I give you back to God.
And in the story, he doesn't forget. He goes on to live his life in the light of the grace that he was shown. He goes on to help those who are also in need and need grace. Have you received God's grace in your life? Jesus read to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. I've done wrong. You've done wrong. And in God's sight, we are sinful. And he's a holy God, a just God. And sin will be punished. But Jesus came to preach this message that there is good news. Good news for sinful people. I don't think he was talking about literally proclaiming liberty to the captives being fulfilled, because we don't read that Jesus did help anyone escape from prison. He's talking spiritually. We are captives to sin. We are captives to the things we can't help doing. But Jesus gives us liberty. He gives us God's grace. Grace is available. It's good news to the poor. Have you received his grace? He's ready to give you his grace. It's unmerited. He wants to pour out things into your life, pour out good things. And do you show grace? Have you shown grace to your children today? Have you shown grace to your work colleagues? Have you shown grace to the person that cuts up in front of you in the traffic and tries to get past the queue and wants to pull in? Have you shown that grace to others? The grace of God. The sovereignty of God. The thing about grace, as we said, it's unmerited. We don't deserve it. But there's two things that I can almost guarantee when you experience grace, when grace is shown to people. That firstly, if you've received grace, you'll have an inclination in you not to share it, because you think it's yours. And if you experience someone else receiving grace, you'll want it yourself, even though you don't deserve it. I have this in my children. If you give a gift to one of them, you know, I can almost guarantee that if I gave a slice of pizza to one of my children, but to none of the others, the rest are most likely to grumble. Why did he get a slice of pizza? And I didn't get a slice of pizza. Because we think that somehow when someone receives grace, we ought to as well. Why? It's unmerited. There's nothing we do to earn the grace that we're shown, yet somehow we begin to see it as a right. Yet God is sovereign. God is in charge. And God does things as he pleases. And you see, we often struggle with the sovereignty of God. The things that God gives to us that we might not want. Plenty of things have happened to me in the last 3 weeks that I would not have chosen. I would not have chosen for there to be traffic lights on the way to the airport that held us up for 20 minutes. It would not have been my choice for the bag drop-off to close halfway through me putting my bags through. I would not have chosen for EasyJet to then lose the bag. I would not have chosen for Liz to have appendicitis symptoms while we were on holiday and have to go to the doctors. There's a whole heap of things in the last 3 weeks. If I could have said to God, yeah, I don't want that, thanks. And if he could have gone, okay, I would have happily gone with that. But God is sovereign and God does what he chooses. We don't get to choose who God gives his grace to, even though sometimes we'd like to. We'd like to keep it for ourselves rather than share it out. Why did the people in this passage reject Jesus? We've just read, they marveled at the gracious words that were coming out of his mouth. They could have picked no hole in what he said. This is good news. So why do they get to the point of trying to throw him off a cliff? What is it about Jesus' message that they reject? And I think there are two reasons. Firstly, they were exclusive. The Jewish people, they wanted to keep the blessings for themselves. The Gentile people, those outside of God's, you know, the people that God had chosen outside of the race of Israel, they didn't want to have that grace being shown to those people. And so he said to them, you know, Elijah was sent to none of those people. but only to someone, to some foreigner. There were loads of people with leprosy, but not to them was Elisha sent. He went to Naaman. And so we are not to try and keep the grace to ourselves that God gives us. We are to try and share it with those who are needy as well. We are not to be exclusive people. God is sovereign and he shares out his grace. But more importantly, I think there's another lesson that we need to learn from why these people rejected Jesus. Jesus told these two stories from the Old Testament. And if you're not familiar with them, I'll tell you what the stories were. So firstly, we had the prophet Elijah. There is a time of drought because he prayed that there would be no rain, and there wasn't any rain for 3.5 years. And so Elijah is beginning to run short of food and drink. And so God says, go to this village outside of Israel. And there a widow is going to feed you. And he finds this widow, and Elijah goes and asks her for some bread. And she said, I've only got a little bit left. It's my last amount. And I'm going to cook the bread, and that's it. Then we'll die. But Elijah says, cook it for me. Give it to me. And don't worry about it. Because when you've done that, God is going to provide us with the food. And so she does. And God does. And they survive. And then you have Elijah's successor, Elisha. There is a foreign commander in the army, Naaman, and he contracts leprosy, a horrible disease that begins to numb you, and you become an outcast in society. And Naaman hears that there's this prophet that can bring healing through God, and so he goes to this prophet, and he brings all sorts of gifts. And Elisha won't take them. Instead, he says, doesn't even say it directly, just sends a messenger to the door and says, go and wash 7 times in the river and you'll be sorted. And Naaman, he says to himself, what? He could have laid hands on me, he could have prayed with me, he could have done some great and mighty work. I don't want to go and wash in this dirty river. Are there not better rivers in my own country? I'm not going to go and do that. And then someone points out, "Wait, it's not that hard. Just go and wash in the river." And he does. And he's healed. In the both cases, one was a poor widow, one was a rich commander. How are they sharing in common the fact that both of them were helpless? The widow had nothing to lose. She might have died a meal earlier. But either way, whether she gave to Elijah or whether she ate it herself, without God's intervention, she was a dead woman. Naaman could take the dipping and perhaps be healed in his mind, or he could not. But either way, he could do nothing about his condition. He was helpless. Both of them were helpless. And Jesus says to these people, I think, in his hometown, you think you're something. You think you've got it made. You think you're all right. They would not have described themselves as poor. They would not have described themselves as needing liberty. They would not have described themselves as blind. They would not have described themselves as needing Jesus. But Jesus is saying, I believe, if you don't come empty-handed to Jesus, you don't come. We don't bring anything of value to Jesus in order to experience his grace. We come empty-handed. We come humbly. And it requires that faith. Naaman brought his gifts, but they were meaningless. The widow had to just do what God said first. It wasn't like she could eat a bunch of bread and then God would provide the miracle and then she could carry on. She had to bring it first. There had to be that step of faith first. If we want to see God working powerfully in our lives, if we want to experience his grace, I believe we need to come to God empty-handed and say, here I am, poor as I am. God, take me, save me, use me. God is sovereign. God is able to rescue us from those things which keep us captive. God is able to help those who are poor. He's good news. But we have to come. These people in this passage in Nazareth, they did not want to come and say, I'm needy. I need you. They wanted all the evidence to come to them. They wanted to be able to see Jesus at work, perform the miracles, and then they'd say, yeah, we will believe in you. Jesus said, no, that's not the way it works. You come in faith, you come empty-handed, and then that's when Jesus is able to work in their lives. Three things that I hope you can take away. I hope that you can remember God's patience. Come to church. Come to church with its warts and all. I hope that you will show grace this week. I hope that you will receive grace this week from others and from God. And I hope that you will share that grace around. I hope that you will come to God empty-handed and say, I don't deserve this grace. I don't deserve it. We've got one more song as we finish. And I like the chorus. In royal robes, I don't deserve, I live to serve your majesty. We read in Revelation about how we come to heaven. And there we are, we're standing in the royal robes, the white robes that God has given us. He's cleansed us, he's saved us. And we can come. We don't deserve them. We live to serve his majesty.